Well, folks, you know, if you're in a leadership role, the burdens of the day kind of get in your head and get in your heart and kind of weigh you down. But today we're going to talk about what it's going to take to make you a happy leader. Hang on.
You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, hello again, everyone. This is Doug Thorpe. You are listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense. And today is going to be a little bit of a departure, I think. My guest today is Mr. Steve Fredlin. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Doug. Happy to be here.
Steve has an interesting body of work where he helps leaders get their happy back. And he's been a keynote, a TEDx speaker, and done a lot of other things. So, Steve, before we kind of dive into the meat of this subject, give us the backstory. How did you come to these revelations, and what's your journey been like?
Yeah, real 10,000-foot view. I'm an actuary by trade, so highly analytical. Did that in the corporate world for 25 years or so in different roles. Also did a lot of humanitarian work on the side. Then about 3.5 years ago, left the corporate world to start my own small business. And so I work with small business owners and entrepreneurs and those folks trying to help them achieve breakthrough and all of those pieces. But along the way, as most of us have, we have these seasons of happiness and unhappiness. And I had some of those in the corporate world where it just didn't make any logical sense, where my life was perfect on paper. I'd been promoted. I was employee of the year, great marriage, great kids. On paper, everything was awesome, but I was miserable. And it started me on a journey to try to figure out what the heck is going on in those situations when I should be, in quotes, happy and I'm not. What's going on? And so I learned some things along the way. I had to repeat a few journeys into the depths of unhappiness to really learn about myself and what's maybe driving that. And then over the past few years, as I've talked to a lot of small business owners, nonprofit leaders, entrepreneurs, and a lot of them are unhappy, even though they feel like they should be. Just having those conversations has led me to a few insights that I feel are really, really starting to help a lot of people break free from unhappiness.
I agree with you, and I've had a very similar journey in several different careers that I've been a part of. Like you say, you've ticked all the boxes, and you should, by most modern standards, be at a level of fulfillment and happiness, but it becomes very elusive, and it's, it gets downright burdensome at times. So, I don't know where you started this onion, but let's do it this way. Let's pretend I and the listeners we're kind of brand new to this idea. How do you crack into this discussion about finding happiness?
Yeah, and just to before I do that, before one of the points that you're making, even because you feel like you shouldn't be unhappy, it makes it even worse because you feel like you have no right to be unhappy, and that makes it even worse. And you feel like, who can I talk to about this? Because who's going to actually sympathize with me being unhappy when my world is so good? So it just sort of creates that spiral. And maybe that's where some of your listeners are involved there in just in that same feeling. Like, I feel like I have no right to complain, and that makes it even worse. And so you just sort of stay trapped in that good life. I call it the good life trap that we're in. But where it starts is really understanding what is really driving our unhappiness. I think, a lot of times we sort of gloss over it, and we sort of have this mentality of, well, we just got to suck it up, right? Like, that's work-life balance basically tells us that work can be miserable as long as we balance it with enough free time. And so we allow ourselves to stay unhappy in our jobs, in our small businesses, in our nonprofits. And I think that's very unhealthy. And I think it's not something we don't need to do, but sometimes I feel like we believe it's the noble thing to do. Well, I'm just going to grab my lunch pail and go to the coal mine and have a terrible day and then come back and, have a beer and watch the game. And we just say, like, that's okay. And so my message to people that are saying, maybe I don't want to be unhappy in my job, in my career, in my life, is really start to understand what is really driving that unhappiness. And it's not the same for everybody. That's the thing. We read articles that say, here's the 10 things to do to become happier. And that works for some people, but it doesn't work for other people. And for the people that it doesn't work for, we read that, we try those 10 things, we light a candle, we start a gratitude journal, we think of, you know, our five favorite friends or those things, you know, and they don't work for us. Now we feel even worse because we feel like, now really what's wrong with me? Here's the 10 things to do to make you happier. And it didn't work for me. And that makes me feel even worse. Like, what's wrong with me? Am I incapable of happiness? And so it just comes back down to really understanding at the core, what is making you unhappy? And take the time to really figure that out and don't gloss over that. So that's where it would all start. If you're trying to get move from unhappiness to happiness, is figuring out what is the root cause of that. And then once you figure that out, it's what does make you happy. And again, this is another thing that seems easy on the surface, but it's harder because we have all of these things that we feel like should make us happy, but it might not make us individually happy. You know, the world tells us, here's what makes you happy. Here's the TV commercials. Or, you know, our friends or our neighbors tell us, here's what makes you happy, because we watch their lives and it's vacations and all of those things, but they might not make you happy. So long answer to a short question, but ultimately it comes down to clarity of what makes you happy and unhappy and really getting landing on understanding that.
Packed a lot of information into that. There's several different dimensions in that I can think of that, you know, firsthand experience working with my own clients trying to do. And so let me kind of reverse it. I mean, I'll go in reverse order of what I think I heard you say. First, the whole idea of this dynamic of information swirling around us. You know, Madison Avenue is famous for telling us what happiness or goodness or success is supposed to be about. You know, is it driving the flashy red car or wearing the right clothes or drinking the right beer or, you know, having the right partner? And those are fundamentally artificial at best. And so I would think that to really do this journey of seeking true happiness, you have to do some heavy work to filter out your definition of what that might be.
Yeah, 100%. You know, and some for some people, those things do make them happy, right? And that's okay. And for some people, they don't. But you can't just grab onto what society says. Here's the normal things to make you happy. If you, you know, drive a Ford truck and sit in the tailgate with a six pack and your favorite partner, you know, like life's going to be good. That's not the thing. And so, yeah, it's heavy lifting. And it starts with, if those things do make you happy or whatever it is that makes you happy, dig deeper into why does that make you happy? You know, what is it about having a new car that makes you happy? Because there's usually something involved there that's a, that gives you some insight into the deeper truth of what you're actually longing for in your life. Is it a status symbol? Is it a feeling that you've arrived? Is it that, you know, that maybe you're good enough, you have what it takes? You know, what is that ultimately related to that charge of happiness you get?
You know, our friends in psychology would tell us that a lot of things are rooted in sort of your own, your nurturing and your upbringing about defining the world around you. And if you come from a home that fundamentally was never allowed to be happy, if I can use that word, that's a hard learning to overcome.
It is. I mean, it's part of my story. It's part of a lot of people's story. You know, the upbringing, I think, really does influence how you perceive the world, your posture in the world, and what you want out of the world. I think for me, you know, I'm in constant pursuit of affirmation. And I hate that about myself, but I need that. I need to make sure that I'm doing okay, that somebody's proud of me, that, you know, because I felt a void in that growing up. And so, yeah, that's just one example, but I think we all have those. And you can decide to either say, well, that's not how it should be. I shouldn't be that way, and just fight it and fight it and fight it. And I think that's going to create this misalignment that's going to make you more and more unhappier, or lean into it a little bit. You know, in some cases, professional help is available, and those are the right things to do. But I think just being honest and authentic with who you are and what you need right now, even if that could change down the road, is so critical.
You know, this is somebody who I am, but as you describe all this, what's part of what's going through my mind is a little diagram that's kind of a Venn diagram, I think, you know, the circles overlapping each other. And, you know, in one of the circles would be that whole idea of what was your upbringing, what was your foundation, what are your fundamental beliefs, and then another circle about what we said about that definition of what is happiness, what should it really be? And then there's probably many more circles, things about your own limiting beliefs, I've certainly met people that just won't allow themselves to be happy.
Yep.
And again, I agree with you. There's probably a root cause buried somewhere deep in there. And I, as a professional coach, I can't venture into the psychotherapeutic part of that, but it is definitely an ever-present aspect of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know it's there. We all have those limiting beliefs, or at least most of us, I think, have some form of limiting belief that's not allowing us to be happy or successful or whatever it might be, because we're so afraid of being that person, or we've had some experience in our life that just, you know, creates a visceral response in us when we see that. And so we don't want to be that person, you know, or it's just not right, right? We grew up because everybody was unhappy, and happy people were the, you know, they're on the other side of the street and we made fun of them or whatever it was. And so we don't want to bridge, you know, over to that side of it and be one of those folks. So, yeah, I mean, psychology is an interesting thing, and we all have these things that we're hardwired a certain way, and we have these experiences that we experienced. And that is what it is. And I think to avoid it, to kind of sweep it under the rug and to ignore it and try to overcome it by just sheer force is not going to get you where you're trying to go. I tried to do that for 40 some years. You know, this is not the kind of person I want to be. So I'm not going to be that person. Right. And just fight it. And what happens is it just creates this misalignment between who we are, you know, at our core, and what our reality is. And that misalignment is really what causes this. I liken it to like your backbone, right? Your backbone is the central support system for your body. And when it's a little bit out of alignment, you just, man, it's uncomfortable, eventually becomes painful, you lose sleep, you become irritable, all of those things. And I feel the same way with our core identity. When our reality is not lined up with our core identity, it creates that discomfort, you know, kind of this chronic pain for a while, but eventually that inflames and it becomes this real painful situation. And we wake up one day just completely unhappy because of it.
I agree. And we certainly see that. And I've certainly encountered that myself through the chapters of my life. I'm thinking there's probably one other element, and I guess I'll go back to my circles diagram, another set of circles, is the idea of the people you allow yourself to be surrounded by. And I'm trying to remember the exact phrase. It was a cute one. Somebody told me one time that I think he was talking about a couple that was having trouble, and he said, "I feel sorry for the guy. His wife's not depressed, but she's a carrier." And
yeah.
And I'm sorry, ladies, not picking on the ladies. I know that equation could go both ways, but the point is, you surround yourself with people of a certain mindset and a certain view of the world. It's inevitable that some of that's going to rub off on you. So,
yeah, and the other way around too. You know, the positive side of that too. My TED talk was the peeps in your Jeep, and it's like surrounding yourself with the right people. Have as you're going through kind of the safari of life, the safari of work, who are the people that are in your Jeep with you? And it's so critical to your enjoyment, to your satisfaction, your contentment, your happiness, to have the right people with you. When you're on safari, you want the people with you that appreciate the historic significance of some of the things that are happening. And, you know, just like in life. And I know that there's a saying, you know, you are the average of the five people you hang out with the most. And there's so much research that shows the impact of the people around you. And it's kind of like some of the other pieces we were talking about, that we have more control than we realize over that. So many of us live our life by default. You know, we lead by default, by what's always been done, by what's expected of us, by what we should do. And the same thing goes with the people that are around us. I think we, you know, we're born into a family, we have neighbors, we go to school, we start a job, you know, all of these people that come into our lives, we don't really have control over. And then we, you know, go into friendships, right? We have to keep these friendships because we went to college with these people. And we have all these people in our Jeep, so to speak, that aren't really the kind of people that we want to be around. They could be great people, but they're not really right for us and what we're trying to do in life and how we're trying to go through life. But yet we feel like we should keep those people in our Jeep and have them sitting right next to us. And the reality is we have so much more control than we ever realized as far as who we surround ourselves with. Yeah, some people, your family, they have to maybe stay in your Jeep because they're your family, but you can seat them kind of in the outside perimeter of your Jeep. They don't have to sit right next to you. They don't have to have the same weight, the same influence in your life you know, move people into your Jeep, move people closer to you and get you where you're trying to go as a leader and as a person, and take control of it. And again, I'm preaching to the choir a little bit because I didn't really realize that I had control over the people in my life until I was in my 40s. But it's so true. And once you do that, when you start surrounding yourself with the right people, man, that unleashes happiness in huge ways.
I agree with you on that sort of career progression and that, what was your phrase, operate by default?
What? Yeah, we operate by default. We lead by default. My talk that I do now, I say, stop living by default. Quit living your life like you're choosing toothpaste. Because we choose our toothpaste by default, right? We don't normally sit around and do a taste test and do studies on which is more effective. We just choose the one that we grew up with. And I think that's how we end up living our lives and leading. We just, well, this is what it is. I'll just do this. And we don't realize that we have control.
It what I was thinking about was that whole idea on the default is in my day, I've done a good bit of career transition counseling, helping professionals either do entire industry changes or get into a whole new lifestyle. And one of the biggest challenges in doing that is breaking that mold. I see people that came out of school, they took a job because they needed the paycheck. Maybe they made an early life decision to get married and immediately start having kids. So the urgency of having a steady paycheck elevates. And it's the paycheck, not the purpose, that, you know, prevails. And next thing you know, you've become reasonably good at whatever that job was. You get promoted a couple times. Maybe you change companies in the same industry, but you get into your late 30s, middle 40s, and you wake up one day and go, why am I doing this? Why, you know, what else is there?
Yeah, and this isn't even my life. And that's, again, like, that could be a really good life. But yeah, you touched on a couple of things there, those shoulds that happen early on. We all have those, like, that's my story, right? Hey, Steve, you're good at math. You should go to college. Well, nobody in my family had ever gone to college, but okay, that sounds good. And I'm not saying these are bad things, right? But, you know, it should. Okay, well, hey, Steve, you're good at math in college. You should become an actuary. Okay. I'll become an actuary. Hey, Steve, you're good at individual contribution. You should become a manager. Okay. You know, and you just sort of do things because that's what you should do, right? You should get married. You should have kids. I did all of those things. And again, it's a great life, so I have no right to complain, but it really wasn't my life. None of those steps were intentional. I never really sat down and weighed no college, technical college, math, English, theater. I never, you know, came out of college going, maybe I'd enjoy writing or marketing more than math, you know? And so it just, all of those things, should I get married? Should I not get married? They just sort of did them because that's what I was supposed to do. And like you said, you wake up then you're 40s and you're like, I have a good life, but it's not even my life, really. I lived the caricature of the middle-aged white American male, you know? And that's where you end up. And you're like, how did I get here from there? If I had my life to do over again, which we don't, as far as I know, and then regret starts to creep in and all of those things. And then you can decide, well, I'm just going to shut it down and say, well, I kind of blew that life, or man, change it, change it. Yeah. Start moving toward the life you envision now.
Start making those transition moves. And speaking of transition, we're going to take a short commercial break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this whole idea of becoming a happier leader. We'll be right back.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
Well, all right, everyone, we're back, and I am talking with Mr. Steve Fredlin. We've been talking about what does it take to be a happy leader, or at least a happier leader. And when we went into the break, we were talking about this idea of living by default. You kind of get into a career path and a lifestyle that maybe is more circumstance than it is intention. And you wake up in the late 30s, middle 40s, and have this revelation, or at least you might start questioning the idea, is there more to this? And I'm reminded on that note, Steve, of a quote that I love from Mark Twain. He said, there's two important days in a man's life, the day he was born and the day he figures out why.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to us some more about that moment of revelation when you start coming to the realization that maybe there is something different or more that ought to be pursued.
Yeah, I think in my experience and talking to the people that I've talked to, I think there's a couple different ways it happens. One is that sort of epiphany day when somebody wakes up and goes, oh my gosh, you know, either I really want to do this with my life. I finally figured out how this life's not so bad, but man, I really want to do that. Or it's this, man, this is terrible. This isn't my life. I need to do something else. So there's kind of those instantaneous moments for some people. And for others like me, it's more gradual, right? I think as I reach my 40s, I'm like, I'm not sure this is what I want to do. You know, started having conversations with my wife, you know, so it's sort of a gradual sort of thing. And I know myself well enough to know that I'm multi-passionate, so I can switch gears really quickly. So is this just a phase where I'm doubting this, you know, all of those pieces. So for me, it was kind of a gradual realization that this isn't it. And as I dug in deeper, started to ask my questions of myself of, who am I? What do I want? Where do I want to go? Who do I want to get there with? How do I want to get there? As I started asking those questions, I realized I'm not really aligned with the life that I want. And so it was a period of time for me to actually get to the point where I felt this isn't my life. But then comes that moment of, are you going to do something about it or not? Yeah. And again, there's no right answer for everybody. But for me, I could have just packed it in and said, you know what? I can do the actuarial gig for another 15 years. And retire and be good, or I could make a change. So for me, I had to face that decision. What am I going to do? How miserable was I? How unhappy was I? What was the potential future happiness? You know, I'm an actuary, of course, so there was probably an expected value calculation in there somewhere. But, you know, I had to, once I came to that realization, I had to decide, am I going to do something about it or not? And we all face that decision differently as well.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point. It is a process of doing the evaluation and doing the question asking of yourself, your spouse, your family. And I guess my message to the younger part of our audience that might be listening is you need to start as early as you become aware of the idea of doing a regular recurring assessment of your life. You know, how are things going? There's a lot of different versions you can look at if you're looking for templates and charts and programs to fill out. But simple things like at the end of the year, it's not so much about writing New Year's resolutions. It's about evaluating and seeing if you're on course, seeing if a vision you've set is being fulfilled as you go forward. And if you've never done that exercise, there's no time like right now to start. You build that new vision. And back in the 2008 timeframe, when I was running a nonprofit for job seekers, we actually had people that built vision boards. It's the literal, mm-hmm. you know, picture board of cut out some pictures in a magazine of where you want to be and where you want to go and what represents what in those values you talked about in the first half. Align those and get that out in front of you so that you've got something to look forward to. And then on a regular basis, revisit that and ask yourself the question, man, am I making progress toward that?
I love it. Yeah, that vision is a powerful, powerful thing. And you alluded to it. It can change over time, but you need to go somewhere. And I'm a fan of the Lewis Carroll book, Alice in Wonderland, you know, and there's basically a great exchange there between the Cheshire Cat and Alice that's paraphrased. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. It's like, okay, well, what decision should I make? Well, I don't know where I want to go. Well, then it doesn't really matter what decision you make. And I think that's where we end up living our lives by default like that, because we don't really have that clear vision of where we're going to go. And yeah, if you're younger, you might not know what that looks like, but take your best shot, surround yourself with the right people. And one great exercise for people that are wondering, man, I don't really know what the vision is for my life. I don't really know what will make me happy. I don't really know if I should go to college or do something else, start a business, work at a Fortune 500 company, is to start keeping track of, and I'm not a big journaler, but this exercise I found incredibly helpful. Just each day at the end of the day, write down what made you happy and what made you unhappy. Don't overthink it. Don't worry about analyzing it. Don't just literally like 30 seconds. What were those moments of happiness? What were those moments of unhappiness? Just do that. That's it, period. And then later down the road, either you can evaluate it or give it to somebody else. Say, can you just look through this journal? I've just got on the left side of every page, I've got what made me unhappy, right side, what made me happy, and just look for themes. Help me out. What are the themes? Because it's not always obvious, right? It's not always going to, it's not going to be like, oh, peanut butter makes me happy and jelly makes me sad. You know, it's going to be, there's these underlying sort of things that, boy, it seems like when you're unhappy is when you are forced to lead things, you know, for example, even though that might not be an obvious thing. So yeah, I think keeping track of it. So I think the vision of where you want to go and then making decisions intentionally in alignment with that vision, like that's the whole point of a vision, is so that when you have a decision or a problem, you can line it up to that and actually make the right decision that that advances the vision. But then also looking backwards, start to evaluate what are those things that make you happy and unhappy, and then start to integrate those as much as you can into your life.
I agree with you. And in all of my executive coaching clients that I've worked with will tell you that's usually one part of the exercise that we go through. I ask them how their vision is for what they're doing and what they think their team needs to be doing. Mm-hmm. Because locking in on that vision, to your point, is really what gives you the base. And I call it the foundation of your ability to respond to future moments rather than just react to them when they show up.
Yeah, that's well said.
If you're locked in on your vision and something happens, you can look at it through the lens of, does this fulfill my vision or does it pull me back or throw me off course? I need to do something different. And then that is a much more positive response to the situation rather than just a knee-jerk reaction, which a lot of times takes us way off course.
It does. It takes us even way worse off. I've done a lot of strategic planning and facilitation and stuff. And I've actually had a couple of incidents, more than one, where they wanted me to come in and do like a 4-hour facilitation to help them figure out, you know, what decision to make in a certain problem that was occurring in this. They're both nonprofits, different nonprofits. And in both cases, like I came in, I just started asking questions for like a half hour about clarifying their vision. Let's clarify your vision. I actually did like a survey in advance, asked everybody, in your own words, what's the vision of the organization? And you get back from all the board members, they're all different, right? Even though the words match, that they're all actually had a different interpretation of the vision. And so I just started facilitating a conversation around clarity of vision. What are you really about? Like, what are you really trying to do? What is the vision? What is the desired future state actually look like? And they had a conversation, and after a half hour, they all looked at each other and they're like, we know what we're going to do. You can actually go. We're done here. They didn't need to have the conversation about the whole, you know, solution, the right decision to make, because once they got clarity on the vision, it was just so obvious
everything
what they should do.
Place.
And we've had a couple of those situations. I'm such a big fan of, like, there's a quote attributed to Einstein about if he had a 60 minutes or whatever, if he had an hour to solve a problem, he would spend 55 minutes on the problem and 5 minutes on the solution, because he's just such a believer that clarifying what the problem is really what drives the solution. So yeah, it's just to your point there, man, the power of vision. And, you know, you talk to so many folks and they say, I'll say, hey, what's the vision for the organization or your company? It's around here somewhere. Here it is. Here it is. And it's, you know, it's a 70 you know, word message that they don't know and doesn't make sense. It's not in their heart. It's not internalized, whatever. And that's not vision. In my opinion, that's a vision statement. It's well written. Wow, very, very well written. But if you can't immediately know what it is, if it's not embedded in your heart, embedded in your team, and every decision is grounded in advancing that vision, you're losing so much power. And so for your own, you know, for the listeners, for their individual lives, for their business, for their school work, whatever it is, man, have that vision and have it be something that you can just really internalize and rally around.
And you said a key word in my mind, clarity. Clarity is such an underrated commodity and requirement in our life and in our business world, for sure. There's a there's a phrase, and I don't even know who I can attribute this to where I first heard it, but the phrase is a confused mind says no. And if you think about that in your own life, if you're, you know, shopping for that toothpaste and you take in too much information, you get yourself muddled and you kind of throw up your hands and go, I'm not going to buy any darn toothpaste right now. You're going to go think about it, or you're going to. So that's an oversimplified example of that you can get too much information. You can get overwhelmed by it. And I think that's especially true in the situation where a vision is missing. You have no clarity. You can't lock in and start defining intentional effort to get there if you don't define that destination. And any road gets you anywhere, you know, that kind of thing. If you haven't defined that, it's way too easy to burn a lot of daylight just floundering and probably falling back into that default lifestyle.
For sure. Yeah. I was working with one small business owner a couple of years ago, and he was sort of the why not guy. Like that's what I ended up labeling him, because I'd be like, well, why did you do this? Well, why not? It was opportunities. You know, it's opportunities would come up in the business. He would say, well, why not? You might be able to make a few hundred bucks or whatever and doing this. So, but he got to this place where, then there's just complete chaos, a complete confusion in what he was trying to do. And he was making money from all these different pieces, but it was just kind of bedlam. Right. And his whole rationale, because he lacked the vision, his rationale was, well, why not? It's a profitable thing, so I'm going to do it. But he didn't have the vision. And so as we worked together and started figuring out, well, what is your vision? Well, man, I want to retire in 8 years. Well, then you got to stop just layering on all of these additional things that you're going to have to unwind later. And so let's figure out how to actually maximize what you're doing. When there's no vision, you know, it's just lost. You're just guessing at that point. You're just guessing and you're hoping. And I tell people, man, hope is a powerful thing, right? Like we hope for a lot of things. I hope I stay healthy. I hope my kids do well. I hope, you know, I hope that the situation in Ukraine resolves. Like we really hope for a lot of things. But when it comes to our business, we can even hope for our business, but it's not a strategy. Like if you find yourself saying, boy, I hope I make more money and I hope I work less hours, and you're not actually doing things to move yourself toward that, then you're just hoping to get lucky. And some people will and some people won't. But, you know, you can really change the odds on that. I'm a poker player. You know, you can change the odds on that by making better decisions. So there's still variance. There's still the human experience is filled with variance. But you improve your chances of having success by making better decisions.
You just, sidebar here, you just told me a secret. And I made a mental note. I'll never play poker with you, an actuary who plays poker.
Well,
I'm not getting into
one thing I learned, though, is when I first started playing like 10 years ago, I just started playing because my kids and I used to go fishing a lot. They lost interest in fishing. And my two buddies, we had like 10 teenage kids between us. We're like, what can we do to connect with our kids? Anybody ever play poker? Somebody brought that up and we started playing. And what I learned pretty quickly, though, is that actuaries get crushed at the casinos playing poker because they're so mathematical in nature. I had to learn that, okay, I wasn't playing my cards. I got to play the player a little bit too. So if you're just purely reliant on math, eventually you will get crushed.
Well, that's good to know too.
Yeah.
Steve, what do you think is the biggest hindrance to people wrestling with this question of how can I be happier with my life and what I'm doing? You have any ideas on what the biggest hurdle may be?
Yeah, when I boil it down, you know, of course I've got to have mathematical equations because I'm that guy, and I've got all kinds of ways to think about frameworks, but clarity plus intentionality equals happiness. Like clarity, clarity, clarity. I know we've said it before, so I'm not going to give you anything new, but that is just it. Like as much as I dig in, as much as I help people look at my own life, look at other people's lives, where people are misaligned, and that misalignment to me is kind of that difference between the life that you want, how you want things to be, and how things actually are. Some of that misalignment comes from just the variance, the human experience. But a lot of that is just from it's a cumulative effect of making decisions that are not aligned with your core identity or what you want for your business. And that comes from a lack of clarity, because how can you make the right decisions that are aligned with who you are if you don't know who you are? How can you make the right decisions that are aligned with your business if you don't know what you want out of your business? And so I'm coming back to, again, clarity, clarity, clarity. And I I guess I can't promise, but to the extent that I can, I promise that if you focus a bit of energy on really clarifying who you are and what you want to get out of your business and out of your life, and then start adding intentionality to that, just put your decisions, put your problems, put all of those situations through the lens of what you now understand about yourself and your business, you're going to start to shrink that gap between where you are and where you want to be.
I love those keywords. Again, we talked about clarity and then the idea of intentionality. Once you create that definition of the direction you want to go, you've got to be intentional about the efforts day by day. We all share one giant thing in common, all of mankind. We have the same number of seconds in the day. Mm-hmm. Every day when every one of us wakes up, we have the exact same opportunity with the way the clock ticks. So the question is, if you scratch your head and say, well, how does Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos do what they do in their day? Well, I guarantee you those seconds are, not all of them, but the vast majority of them are spent with very intentional effort.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there's some shortcut accelerators to helping you stay more intentional. One is just wake up every day and have your little, your vision statement or whatever written down and just remind yourself, oh yeah, here's who I am. Here's what I want to do with my business. And then we touched on it before, surrounding yourself with the right people. I'm in a mastermind. I started, it's a free mastermind with a few people that I know. I'm like, all right, we're going to get together every week for an hour, kind of bring our problems or whatever that we're wrestling with and help each other. But it's just it's a weekly reminder. People will hold you accountable. Say, hey, man, I got this idea to do this with my business. And somebody will say, that doesn't seem lined up with your vision, or they'll have an idea that is lined up with the vision. And so I think that's a clarity plus intentionality, but then creating an environment where your vision stays in front of you and the intentionality has to stay on track.
Yeah. Yeah. And that just reminds me of a colleague of mine talking about just options and tools to make this happen. A friend of mine introduced me to a program a long time ago. He calls the Big Five, plain and simple. And he introduced it to me in a work context. He actually was a subordinate manager working for me at the bank we were together in many years ago. We were going through an inordinately busy season, and it was hard to connect and hard to, exchange updates and ideas. One day he just threw this piece of paper on my desk, and there are these five bullets, and I looked at it and I said, what is this? And he said, it's my Big Five. Take a look at it and call me when you want to talk about it. And I said, whoa, okay, time out. Let's explain this to me.
Back up.
And so what he said was, well, here's my view of the five most important things I need to be focused on right now. It'll probably take the next month to get them done. Mm-hmm. And when the month rolls over, I'll be back to you with my update. And he said, do you agree with these five as priorities? And I looked at him and I said, one and two, yes. I said, not so sure about three. Why don't we park that? Here's my idea. Go do this. And he said, great, no problem. And four and five were okay. So he took off, and sure enough, the next month he came in. Now he had two sets. One at the top was accomplishments, and at the bottom was the priorities for the next month. And we started this discipline of looking at that. And, they were strategic enough that it wasn't a day-by-day task list by any means, but it was chunks of work that had to be processed and carved out and accomplished. And we aligned the priorities. He got his team to do those things. And all of a sudden, the unit productivity started climbing up the chart. And you can talk about KPIs and all that other stuff. In my mind, they only became proof of that effort to be intentional about what the priorities were. So it was more meaningful than goal setting, which a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about. But it was very strategic and tactical, both at the same time. So we could look at strategic initiatives if we were, let's say, converting a computer system. Well, you don't do that overnight, you know, so that may be the big strategy and it might take 6 months to do that, but you've got priorities in the course of those 6 months that you need to chip away at to make it successful. And he's now turned that into an actual business that he teaches companies, and he's got client companies that have their whole workforce doing a big five up the chain. And everybody on a work team gives a big five report to their manager, and every manager rolls something up and gives it to his boss, and so on and so on. And he's written a software app, you know, cloud-based app that manages all this stuff. And it's a very powerful solution.
I love it. It brings like the vision, which seems like, you know, can be vague when you have a lot of employees, but it brings it down to that one level. Okay, for you, what are your, you know, five priorities that line up with the vision? Then there's accountability. And then you kind of trust people. Okay, you're professional. Go do what you need to do to make progress on this thing. But that accountability of saying, okay, how do we do on the big five? And then there's the flexibility. Now, it's not like annual goals that don't change, right? It's like, okay, next month, now what are the new, maybe they're the same, maybe they've changed. I think that's great. Yeah. And I love the idea of big five because it's near and dear to my heart in Africa. You got the big five animals in Africa.
Oh, yeah. So
right there, I've got to have like, okay, lion, leopard, hippo, cape buffalo, black rhino. Here we go. There's my big five. But I love that idea. I think that's a great management tool.
Well, and it has a lot of other implications. He was an HR guy by trade, and he wanted to do it for annual appraisal processing. Mm-hmm. Because if every employee in your company is filling this out every month, then when it comes time for your annual, you know, review cycle, you got 60 data points to look at.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah.
And there's clarity, and employees never surprised, because if the managers are doing the right thing, every time the employee shows up with their monthly report, you can give them that feedback on the spot.
Yep.
You know, great job, or not quite, didn't quite make it. You seem to be missing the point. Let's coach this up. Let's figure this out together. And you get all of that. So back to what you and I've been saying, you've got clarity, you've got intentionality, you got priority. And I use the phrase, everybody is literally on the same page.
Yeah. Yep. And it's sort of a self-correcting thing. Like you said, you kind of know, are you meeting your objectives or not? Let's correct this thing before a year goes by, because I mean, probably a lot of us have been in those situations where you get to the end of the year and you're like, how'd you do? You know, because you don't have any monthly reviews or quarterly reviews. And you're like, everybody's kind of going, well, let's see how this goes. I think I had a good year. I don't know. And like, nobody really knows. Now, how terrible is that? And it's just such terrible leadership.
HR data tells us that the preponderance of input that goes into those in that scenario you just described is the last 90 days. And so you
100%.
You missed three quarters of the year.
You see people do it. You see people ramp up because it's getting close to review time. Yeah. And I'm like, how is this even a thing? It's terrible. But it's the game, right? It's the game, right? We all naturally play the game.
Yeah.
Whatever game is in front of us.
Well, Steve, I think we're kind of coming up on our time here. This has been great. Tell people the best way to get a hold of you if they want to know more about your work.
Yeah, probably the best way is LinkedIn. That's the social media platform I'm most active on. I do a little daily video there called Steve's Daily Stool. And yes, that is intentional. It's me on a stool just trying to share some thoughts that I have. And then I've got a couple of websites that you can get to from there. But smallsmallbusiness.com is really around the coaching consulting that I do with a focus on the micro businesses and the small nonprofits. And then stevefredlund.com is really more geared toward my keynote speaking.
Great. Great. We'll have all that information in the show notes, folks, if you need to get back at it. But any closing thoughts, Steve?
It's been great. I mean, I have so many questions for you, Doug. Like, I want to be on the other side of the microphone and asking you all kinds of questions. But no, I think, you know, wherever you are, who's ever listening to this, I'd say my only piece is you have runway in front of you, right? You don't know how much time you have, even if it's 5 years, man. Let's make that a good 5 years. Live the kind of life that you want. I think we all live with a little bit of regret in our lives, but we can reverse some of that. You know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the next best time is now. I think take that to heart and change your life a little bit. You have more control than you realize. And I think take it from a from an introverted recovering actuary, you can actually change and sort of break out of the mold and have the life that you want. So just encouragement and way to go, all of you folks that are out there just cranking it day in and day out, way to go. But carve out the life that you want and start with vision and clarity.
That's great. And again, thank you, Steve, for sharing all this. Folks, I think this has been a great reminder of the need to really do that evaluation and do that course correction along the way and get that clarity and intentionality so that you can build the life that is not just about some kind of material success, but really a fulfilling and ultimately we would use the word happy. So I hope this has been helpful. This is another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. It's been great having you with us. I look forward to having you in the next episode. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.